Welcome, fellow true crime enthusiasts, to today's case file, Who Murdered Jimmy Gaul? Who is David William Adams? Welcome to Body of Crime, your go-to true crime podcast, where we plunge headfirst into the gripping world of criminal mysteries. Join your hosts, Jose Medina, Crystal Garcia, and Alicia Anaya, as we deliver the full stories, immersing you in the heart of each case. With spine-chilling cases, in-depth analysis, captivating interviews, and a comprehensive examination of the evidence, embark on a thrilling journey with us as we explore bone-chilling cases from around the globe. Whether you're a seasoned true crime enthusiast or a fresh face in the genre, we guarantee to keep you on the edge of your seat. So put on your detective hat, grab your notepad, and get ready to dive into the thrilling world of Body of Crime. In the last episode of this series, we completed the deep dive into the Garreau family, ending with Randolph Eugene Garreau. Randolph, who sometimes went by Randy, and other times went by a shortened version of his middle name, Gene, had a penchant for finding trouble everywhere he went. It was a trait that Randy shared with his older brother, Bill Garreau. During last week's episode, we learned about Randy's brutal sexual assault of one of his very own neighbors, strangling the woman, and then, after finding her still breathing, stabbing her to death with no remorse in her own home, just a few doors down the street from where he lived with his family. Not even a month would pass before Randy attempted to sexually assault another woman, this one his next-door neighbor. What she had not known at the time was that she had not only prevented the sexual assault with her quick thinking, but she had avoided potentially being murdered, as Randy was not afraid to take a life to cover his evil deeds. It is unknown how many other lives he might have taken that have gone undiscovered throughout the years before he was finally stopped, but the frequency between these two incidents make us believe that they could not have been the only ones. Randy would spend the rest of his life in prison, but that would not subdue his evil streak, and his prison records were full of infractions and violations. Randy was a bad seed, and the prison system made it a habit of transferring him constantly, developing almost an annual pattern of transfers between different prisons as he languished behind bars. Incapable of taking any real responsibility for his crimes and the devastation that he left behind, Randy used personal ads in the paper to lure women, with cries of unjust imprisonment and wrongful conviction. This allowed the rekindling of an old flame, a younger girl who purported Randy to be her first love, but that flame smoldered and the reconnection dropped like a poor AT&T phone call. Randy would perish in prison alone after years of sickness and poor health. The question that we continue to wrestle with today is, were either of the Garreau boys responsible for the murder of young Jimmy Gaul? This question has kept us digging further into the Garreaus, traveling through a myriad of rabbit holes and finding different threads of suspicion, and what we've found is either a chilling coincidence or a terribly frightening revelation. Today's question is, who was David William Adams? And what is his connection to young Jimmy Gaul?
On May 3rd, 1968, the day began like any other day in the life of an 8-year-old Clark Elementary School third grader named David William Adams. On this particular day in Issaquah, Washington, David had gone to school dressed to impress in a green and brown plaid shirt, jeans, and high-top shoes. At the end of the day, as he rode the school bus home, he was excited about hanging out with his friends. The temperature would have been slightly chilly, around 68 degrees with an overcast sky, but it wasn't raining, and David planned to play until it was time for dinner. David knew that he had to be home by 5 p.m., but he called his mom to beg for more time with his friend. However, David's mother could not be swayed, and she told him to be home by 5 o'clock. The Adams had only been living in the neighborhood of Issaquah near the Tiger Mountain for about 2 weeks, having relocated from Bellevue, Washington State in the Issaquah Alps region. In the late 1960s, this area was primarily known for its natural features and outdoor recreational activities. It was a patchwork of private and public lands, but they were experiencing significant clear-cutting as Boeing brought new residents into the surrounding communities of Seattle. Many Washingtonians, or Toners as they referred to themselves, enjoyed the mountain activities like hiking, mountaineering, and trail exploration. Tiger Mountain had a history of coal mining in the early 20th century. However, by the late 1960s, mining activities had ceased, and the primary focus of the mountain shifted more towards outdoor recreation and conservation efforts. Tiger Mountain's natural beauty and the accessibility made it a popular destination for outdoor enthusiasts seeking to explore the Issaquah Alps. David likened himself a hiker and took the most adventurous route home, a shortcut, much like a hiking trail. At around 5:15 p.m., Mrs. Adams became annoyed when David had not yet arrived home. He was usually very punctual, and she thought maybe he had lost track of time. So she phoned David's friend's home, but was surprised that David wasn't there, and he had not yet made it home. David was about 4 feet tall, and he weighed a mere 50 to 60 pounds. He was slender, with pale skin, dark brown hair, and blue eyes, with two crooked front teeth that promised braces in his future. He had a dimple in his left cheek, which was visible when he smiled. David was reported missing, and a search was conducted by more than 1,000 volunteers that included law enforcement, bloodhounds, members of the community, and even military aircraft equipped with heat signature detection equipment. They combed the neighborhood and the Tiger Mountain area, but David was nowhere to be found. Search dogs stopped in front of a neighbor's residence, which caused investigators to quickly identify a person of interest at that residence. There was a theory that David could have fallen into a coal shaft. Another theory was that David had been attacked by a bear or a cougar. There was even a far-fetched theory that he had maybe traveled to Oklahoma on his own in search of his father, Captain William Adams, who was attending training at Tinker Air Force Base. Days turned to weeks, weeks to months, and months turned to years, and then decades would pass with no sign of little David.
In the heart of Salt Lake City, amidst the towering spires of the Church of Latter-day Saints, Logan Temple, 25-year-old William Donald Adams married Anne Lorraine Gwynn in a beautiful ceremony surrounded by friends and family members. William, fresh from Brigham Young University with a degree in physics, had found his soulmate, and the couple didn't waste any time starting a family. The Adams first settled in California, prior to moving to Bellevue, Washington, where, ironically, their home address was within 6.5 miles of where the Garros resided in Bellevue in 1968. Although William began his aerospace career in the world of physics at Douglas Aircraft in California, he would eventually take a role with Boeing in Seattle. This would be the same Boeing and at the same time that Randy and Bill's parents would both be employed at the same Boeing facility. The Adams family blossomed rapidly with the birth of their sons, Stephen and David, and with the turn of each year, their family continued to grow, soon welcoming Jill, Kevin, Paul, and finally Brooke. With the new role at Boeing, William made a move to relocate his family to Issaquah at the foothills of the Tiger Mountains in a new subdivision very similar to Citrus Heights, California, where the Garros had lived only 4 years prior. David's disappearance on May 3, 1968, came as a shocking blow to the Adams family, destroying their trust in the community and thrusting them into a dark state of confusion, sadness, and misery. David had been born on January 26, 1960, and had just turned 8 a few months prior at the time of his abduction. He was an adventurous Aquarius, both independent and unpredictable, but also friendly and creative. Ironically, David's father was a scoutmaster, another passion that the Garros shared beyond their childhood and into their adult lives. If you recall, Bill would eventually become a scoutmaster a couple years later under an assumed name in California after the family relocated from Bellevue, Washington to California. David's disappearance cast a pall over their family's lives, leaving unanswered questions and aching hearts, and for years, they clung to hope that they would learn what had happened to David. But as time moved forward, the family came to terms with the bitter truth and the fact that they might never learn what happened to little David. As the parallels of these three families' lives unfold, the Galls, the Garros, and the Adams, it's impossible not to recognize the eerie coincidences and alignments between them. Like young Jimmy, little David was in elementary school and disappeared in the middle of a normal day. Jimmy disappeared on May 2nd, David on May 3rd. The Garros appear to be a common denominator in both scenarios, with their proximity to both Jimmy, who they lived next door to, and David, who they lived very close to. Jimmy's father was employed by Aerojet, whom the Garros' father and elder stepsister also worked for. And then they were employed by Boeing, who David's father also worked for. David's father was a scoutmaster. The Garros were heavily invested into the Boy Scouts, as was their own father. The Garros' future behavior show a pattern of sexual dysfunction, predatory behavior, and a lack of morals that would see them both in prison for long stretches of their lives, with Randy eventually dying while still incarcerated.
Whoa. How did we find this other victim, David?
So being that we know that the Garros tended to get in trouble with every move, there seemed to be something that would kind of lead to their moves. We decided to look specifically in Washington because that was the next place that they went after, you know, California. And then, of course, they returned to California to a different area. And in doing so, we were looking at like missing persons, specifically closer to Jimmy's age. And Karen actually stumbled upon David. Initially, when, you know, we spoke about it, we, of course, wanted to look and see, well, is there really any need to look at this? Yes, you know, he's close to the same age. And it started to become pretty eerie, honestly, to see the similarities, not just in the family makeups, but also in the distances, the type of neighborhood, that the parents worked together, all of those things. And so we started to dig further.
What was it that you guys found in terms of like the crime? Like what was the circumstances around his abduction?
Like we said, he had gone to a friend's house after school that day and just, you know, like a normal day. And they had only been there for a couple weeks. So they had moved from the neighborhood that they were in. And really what, I don't know that it was part of their move because this was actually, I believe, a brand new house. That house was built that year. But their dad was activated, placed on active duty, and ended up being, he was a captain in the Air Force. Yeah. And so during that time, shortly after their move, he was sent to Oklahoma and they had only been in this new house for a couple weeks. Now, the reason that he already had friends there is because their family was very active and still is very active in the Church of Latter-day Saints. And he knew a lot of kids from the church who went to the church who lived in that neighborhood. So this right. was a kid he had known for a while. He went to play at his friend's house. You know, he knew that he was supposed to be home at 5 for dinner, called his mom, and his mom's like, no, you need to come home. And he didn't live that far away from his friend's house, but he decided to take a shortcut, which wouldn't have been much of a shortcut, you know, between the two houses, but he took a shortcut and nobody was outside physically observing him walk home. And so at the point he left his friend's house, nobody saw him in between then and then, of course, him going missing. What comes out a little bit later is, you know, somebody had made a comment that they had had a witness that had made a statement that near this trail where they thought he had taken to, I guess, go home, that they had seen somebody that looked like they could have been, you know, in their teens. Then when police looked at old police records and saw that the dogs had stopped in front of a particular house and the person who lived in that house happened to be around that age, they decided to hone in on that person and they actually reopened the case at a certain point. And so that became their person of interest. But nobody, you know, had, at least during that time frame, had really seen him. Where the dog stopped is where his scent ended. That doesn't mean necessarily that he was at that house, and they did go search the house. So that just means that the scent ended there. So he could have been picked up in a car, anything of that nature. And
right.
And being that they conducted this search, and at the time, heat signature was new That was something new. So, and because he was Air Force and he had his connection with the Air Force, they did participate in the search. They didn't find anything. Now, the following day, there was a couple witnesses who said that they had observed him a little bit further from the house. And I think this kind of aided in the whole theory of him being all right in the beginning. Because in the beginning, everybody was thinking he was fine, that right. maybe he had gotten lost. They had only lived there a couple weeks.
Right.
And so when these other witnesses come out, they were like, well, we just assumed he was fine, but we think it's him, you know. And one of the people who said that they saw him, her daughter was friends with him. So they assumed it had to be the right person, but it was the following morning and it was further away from the house, which would have actually been closer to where the Garros lived. But they weren't really able to confirm that. And of course, nobody has ever seen or heard from him since. The different theories when they reopened the case, the police really felt like because that individual who became the person of interest, because he hadn't been talked to when they went and talked to him, they felt like it was a key to the case that had been missed early on. And they felt like the other scenarios that had kind of come up early in the beginning, like him going to Oklahoma or him getting lost and, you know, and something happening like a cougar getting him or a bear getting him, just wasn't logical. Even him falling in a mine shaft, which they did look at those places as well, that just didn't seem logical to them.
I don't know how well the dogs were tracking back then, but one of the things that I've learned recently is that tracking dogs, they're either good at tracking live or they're good at tracking the dead. They're not good at tracking both. And typically that's defined during the beginning of their training. I found that surprising. And so I kind of question the dog that they used. Was it the right dog?
They didn't say, because there's a couple areas where it says bloodhounds. And right. then there's a couple areas where it just says, I forgot how they called it, but like a search dog. I can't remember off the top of my head what it was that they used for the search, but they used something of his. They used something of David's, obviously, to try to pick up his scent. But where his scent ended was in front of that house, which would have been before his house. With this individual, some things, you know, that I think are important to note, because if you were to go look David up and, you know, look his case up, you're going to see a lot of old stuff like on Reddit from, you know, different people talking about the case, different things that people had heard. One person had said that they had heard something that maybe this guy had newly laid concrete. That wasn't true. You know, people talk about him leaving and joining the service and leaving right after this took place. And I don't know if he joined or if he was drafted at that point in time, but he did go to Vietnam. He got hurt. He got an award and he served honorably. He got out honorably. He's married now. Like, he's had no criminal history, not before then, not after then. So not to say that there's 0% possibility that that person of interest could in any way be connected to his disappearance, but it's highly unlikely.
Wow. And then there's 1,000 volunteers that are out there looking with the community. It really brings me back to Citrus Heights and the search for Jimmy and the parallels between what that must have been like searching for this boy who was out there by himself, you know, everybody thinking they're going to find him okay. And the similarities between, did he just wander off? Did he just get lost? Did he go to the carnival by himself? Like, those are the questions that were probably being asked when everyone's looking for him out there. And it's just eerie.
Yeah.
The similarities.
And in the beginning, you know, his parents were kind of like, he'll be okay. Like, they felt like he was obviously not a pro, but like, he was an outdoors type of kid. He was smart. He was, you know, a rambunctious kid. And his parents felt like if he did get lost, we think he'll be okay. Like, he'll make it somewhere where he can, you know, somehow they'll get a hold of us or whatever. So, but in the beginning, I don't think his parents were really thinking he's not coming home.
What can you tell us about David's family, besides David's father being in the Air Force?
David's father actually worked for Boeing for a very long time. He did that little, you know, when they activated him or whatever, and then he continued to work for Boeing. So he stayed in that industry. They actually stayed in the same neighborhood for a very long time, very active in that same church for years, and really developed a lot of friendships and community, you know, relationships in that area. After so many years, the family really made peace with the fact that they knew he wasn't coming home I don't think they really had an expectation that anything would change in the case, I guess, if that makes sense. When they reopened the case, even at that point, I think the family was kind of, well, they all had a little bit different feelings. You know, the kids were different ages back then. You know, it had been so many years at that point. I want to say it had been a little over 40 years. The siblings were a little bit different as far as how they were taking things, because of course it hit the media again. And of course, people want to start asking questions and stuff starts happening online. And there was a couple comments where, you know, some people were saying, you know, I don't even know that they really even want to know at this point what could have happened. Like, they've made peace now for it all to come up and then to find out, you know, how and all of those things. They're at peace, I guess, is the most important thing. And we actually reached out to some of the siblings and to the mother, because the mother and father, David's mother and father, are both still alive. One of David's sisters messaged me back, and really what we were trying to find out was if they remembered the Garros, because I wanted to see if there was a relationship there at all. And they did say that they knew the Garros.
So there is a connection with the Garros and with this family.
Right. What I want to stress is that in the world of crime, we know that a stranger committing a crime against somebody that they don't know is less likely. So
it's rare.
It's very rare. It is rare. But we also have like almost 50% of murders that aren't prosecuted, like that are unsolved cases, right, technically. So could those results be a little bit skewed? Maybe. But it is rare to have a complete stranger who you've never heard of that did something, you know, especially right, an abduction or murder or anything of that nature. So to know that they knew them is a significant piece of that puzzle.
I would think so. And I would also think that if the detectives that were investigating this abduction were to have known about the proximity of the Garros to the murder of young Jimmy Gall, that they may have at that point become persons of interest.
Right.
Because of the similarities of the case, the similarities of the age, the proximity in the neighborhood and things like that. Like, there's a lot of coincidences there that are just very strange.
The thing is that even now, there's a lot of different systems within the law enforcement network that don't communicate. And especially back then, state to state, you didn't have any connection at all. Even right now, it's like, in order for you to find particular kinds of cases, they have to be entered into a particular system in most cases. So I won't get real heavy into that, but a lot of those systems don't communicate. So it wouldn't have been easy for a detective in Washington to even know, have on their radar, that there was a similar case or something that maybe should have keyed them into looking at. They wouldn't have even known. They would have had no idea.
Unless someone knew the Garros were there or saw them or someone had some kind of link to them, there's no way the cops would even looked in that direction.
Right.
In terms of the family, what is the coincidence that the families would all be connected? That Jimmy Gall's and the Garros family would be connected by the job at Aerojet, and then the Garros would be connected to the Adams by Boeing.
It's crazy. I'm not going to lie, it kind of, and I don't typically talk about, I guess, my personal feelings typically, but it was pretty gut-wrenching to find those similarities, because you want to think, if somebody's capable of this, like, maybe they didn't do this in a whole lot of places. To see another family who is experiencing something similar to what the Gall family is experiencing. And not just that, but the community as well. That community would have experienced a lot of the same things that, you know, Jimmy's friends and family and community is experiencing even today.
The same.
And so to see that, it just is so tragic.
It is. It really is. And then the other similarity too is the connection to Boy Scouts. The fact that, you know, David's father was a scoutmaster. So was the Garros father, was also a scoutmaster. There's a lot of connection there. Was David in the Boy Scouts? And could he have spent time around the Garros in Boy Scouts?
I don't know that at that point that the Garros were active in the Boy Scouts. That doesn't mean that their dad wasn't participating somehow, some way. But there's still some other details that we're trying to kind of comb through and pull together. But we're also pushing this information forward to those law enforcement agencies as well.
Yeah, I don't believe in coincidences. And once you start looking at all the similarities between the two cases, and then you start, you know, looking at the connections there, it could be nothing or it could be everything. Let's talk about this person of interest and how easy it is to become a person of interest in a crime. All it really takes in order to become a person of interest in a crime is proximity, right? You just got to be close to the crime when it happens. You don't have to be involved in it. You don't have to be a participant. You can just be close by. So for example, if someone broke into a house and you were going for a walk and you walked across the front yard, someone could see you there and go, "I saw Joe at the same time when the crime was being committed, walking in front of the house. So he must have been the burglar," right? So proximity is a big one. And sometimes evidence can point you in the wrong direction. So for example, in this situation, when we're talking about David disappearing, we look at the fact that the bloodhounds led to the front house. That causes you to deduce that, oh, this must have been the last place that he was, and so he must still be here, right? Or he must have been taken into the house, and so this is where the trail stops. This is our person of interest. This person could have had nothing at all to do with this, but because that's where the trail ends, he's somehow implicated as a person of interest.
One of the things that they said is that this person of interest didn't have a good alibi, and I guess he had gone and had dinner or something with his family, and they had come home, and shortly after, he participated in the search for him, because keep in mind that he was an adult at this point in time. And so when you have a witness come out and say, "Oh, well, I saw somebody around this age in this area," so they're like, okay, that could be him, right? Even though he wasn't home at the time, based on that timeline, it didn't seem like he would have been home at that time. He wouldn't have arrived home until, you know, just before they were starting to do the search. But the other thing too is that when you have detectives today looking back at a cold case, and they're saying, how come nobody talked to this guy? And so when they're piecing things together and they're like, oh, well, that could be him. He was about that age. And oh, and also the dog stopped in front of that house, which is where we believe he lived during that time frame. And so you start piecing those things together, and now it becomes more likely, you know, more likely that you could be a person of interest.
Right.
And so when they say he didn't have a good alibi, did he not have a good alibi because they said he hadn't been talked to originally, you know? So did he not have a good alibi 41 years ago, or did he not have a good alibi 41 years later? Who remembers? I barely remember when I did yesterday,
right.
You know? It's going to be real hard for me to remember what I did 41 years ago.
Right. No, absolutely. He was part of the search party, so emotionally, he would have a recollection of that day,
right?
Because it would have been something traumatic. He participated in the search. Yeah, he would have remembered that day, but you're right. He may not have remembered what he did before he began searching for this missing boy.
Right.
Back in the 1960s, there were no electronic signatures. There were no electronic trails. So you couldn't like look at his cell phone and go, oh, it pinged here, it pinged there. And so he must have been in the proximity. You know, back then your alibi was just what you said it was. Oh, I was at the store, you know? Oh, well, who can vouch for you if you were at the store? And if somebody else can vouch for you, then your alibi is good. But it's very shaky. It's not like it is today where they can pull your GPS out of your car and go, wait a minute, you were down the street from there where this happened, you know? And right now that's a big deal. And back then we didn't have that. So alibis were a lot easier to get away with back then too.
Some of the things, so even in like Jimmy's case with Vandegrift, who found the body, one of the things that they used to solidify his alibi was receipts from places he went to. So
right.
Like when he got gas and, you know, who did you talk to while you were there? And they were able to solidify his alibi based on that.
Sure.
So with somebody of his age, which he wasn't a child, he was
teen.
Yeah, he was a teen.
Teen adult.
And being with his family, he wasn't going to have receipts like that. So yeah, his alibi wasn't going to be to today's standards, wasn't going to be a, you know, a solid alibi.
Right.
And, you know, and then some of the little things that they kind of latched onto during this time as well was things like, you know, first of all, I'm just going to say, for you to even be willing to take a lie detector test, not to say that somebody absolutely wouldn't, because I know that people have, but first of all, you should always have an attorney. You really should. And any half-decent attorney is going to tell you not to take a lie detector test. One, it's not admissible in court. And yes, it can cause people to say, oh, well, we definitely need to dig into you further if you fail a lie detector test. But they have been shown not to be 100% accurate, which is why they're not admissible in court. And because there can be some, you know, difference in people testing them, just a lot of different things.
Right.
So for him to have agreed to take a polygraph test, to me, signals more on the side of there's a possibility that he's telling the truth.
It wasn't that he was sitting there thinking, I can beat this polygraph test. Yeah.
Not just that, but when he went to Vietnam, like I said, he had gotten hurt. He came home with a Purple Heart and he came home with PTSD. He has no record. He's been married for a while. There's a lot of different reasons why that test could have been, why that could have happened, that doesn't have anything to do with his guilt. And then there was a couple things said about that. One of the things that they used in reopening the case was that maybe he had been talking to people. And so one of the things that they did was they pulled his cell phone records and they got a search warrant and started going through his phone.
This is 40 years later.
Right.
Yeah. When there's phones.
Right. When there's phones. And so, of course, they didn't find anything. They never were able to even arrest him. They didn't charge him with anything and all of that. And his brother's been a big advocate for him, which naturally, if you're like, hey guys, come on, like you're just picking the most, you know, he's one of the only people that's still alive that you can even speak to about this, that people have either tried to finger or said maybe he could be him based on what the witnesses said. And actually, I don't think anybody ever came out and said, I saw him. It was more of a, I saw somebody who looked kind of like this around this age.
Right.
So it could have been somebody completely different.
And it was more than likely somebody completely different. And if you look at the Scott Peterson case, how many people saw Lacey Peterson after the December 24th? She was seen like 100 times after we know she was already dead.
Right.
So an eyewitness to seeing a person, especially when you don't know the person, it's very hard to definitively say, this was the guy that I saw. Because a lot of times you're just generalizing a person's appearance. It's a white guy, or it's a black guy, or it's an Asian lady, or it's an Asian man, or whatever. Like you're not really able to distinguish one person from another when you don't know them. So right now I'm doing research on the Green River Killer. We've requested an ability to interview him in prison. So I've been doing research on him. And one of the things that stood out, I'm thinking about now, because we're talking about being a person of interest, in the investigation of the Green River Killer, there were over 300 persons of interest. More than 300 people who detectives said could have been the Green River Killer.
So there is a difference between a person of interest and a suspect.
A lot of times the media will say that a person is a person of interest. Other times they are a suspect. Do these terms matter, and do they give you any different legal rights? When law enforcement or media are talking about a person of interest, what they're saying is, we believe this person may have information about the crime. So there's no suggestion of wrongdoing in that case. If there was a robbery that happened at a gas station and a witness was at the pump next to it, and maybe they didn't stick around to make a statement, the police may label that person a person of interest. They have information about the case because they may have personal knowledge, something they personally witnessed. Of course, further down the scale is a suspect. A suspect is when the police think that the person may have committed the crime. Now, there's no requirement that a person begins as a person of interest and then escalates to a suspect. And a lot of times people become suspects, and then it becomes clear they could not have committed the crime, and then they're no longer a suspect. Just because a person hasn't been labeled a suspect yet does not mean that all the police don't think that that person committed the crime.
Anytime that somebody's murdered, they start internally and move their way out. They start to rule people out. So a wife, a husband of a victim is always going to be the first
person of interest.
So so they'll call them a person of interest. This is a person of interest. Right. This is a person of interest. That occurs until they can officially label somebody a suspect based on there being some type of receipts, so to speak, that link that person. They were near the vicinity within a certain time. You know, we found something in their house that was matched something from the crime scene, things like that. As they start tying those things together, then they label you a suspect.
Suspect, right.
So they're different. So I just want people to understand that, because when you hear somebody talk about a person of interest, it is not the same thing as a suspect. And a lot of times, not so much in the past, obviously we know that back in the 60s, they were putting people's addresses and names and everything in there, who the witnesses were and all of that, which is just crazy to think of today.
You could also smoke on a plane.
Isn't that crazy? And they had cigarettes and MREs, but which they still have matches in there. I'm not sure why. But you know, today, in order for, you know, the media to put somebody out, generally, unless there's family members, I know that we see a lot of cases, you'll see a lot of cases come up on TikTok where, you know, like a family's been interviewed and, you know, somebody's saying, oh, I think the mom or I think the dad or, you know, whatever. But the media is careful about not revealing somebody's name who hasn't been labeled a suspect. And if somebody has been labeled a suspect, generally you're going to hear about them, especially if it's a high profile case, even if they end up later being ruled out. But like with this individual, they didn't release his name. We do have his name and we've actually reached out to him and his brother. But when the media spoke with the individual and with his family after the case had been reopened and they questioned him and all these things took place, the media chose not to disclose his name.
41 years after the disappearance of little David, a cold case squad based out of Keene County, Washington, reignited hope in the family, breathing new life into David's case when David's cold case was reopened. The cold case detective discovered an initial person of interest that had not originally been questioned at the time of David's disappearance. The man quickly became a prominent person of interest as the detectives honed in on him. The detectives became focused when the suspect began exhibiting evasive behavior and subsequently failed a polygraph test. But throughout all the additional scrutiny, no arrests were ever made. No charges were ever filed, leaving the Adams family short of closure and exasperated that they had relived a traumatic event 40 years later for nothing. It is easy to become a person of interest in a crime. It only takes proximity and a weak alibi to draw the attention of detectives desperate for answers. Was this person of interest responsible for little David's disappearance? With no criminal history, no record of sexual deviance, no incidents of poor judgment, this Vietnam veteran suffering from PTSD could be a distraction from the real perpetrator of David's abduction. Do the Adams know the Garros? Well, we know now that they did. We reached out and they responded. Could the answer lie closer to home than anyone ever imagined? With each new discovery, the boundaries between coincidence and reality blur, leaving us to grapple with the unsettling possibility that there may be more to these events than meets the eye. As the search for truth presses on, we're left to wonder, who is David William Adams? Did his path ever cross the Garreau boys? What secrets lie buried beneath the surface of his disappearance? And what, if anything, does that tell us about young Jimmy Gall? And that's a wrap on today's investigation, fellow detectives. If you found this episode both enlightening and captivating, then please subscribe to our podcast show and our Patreon. Leave a review and hit that like button. Share our podcast with others and engage with us on our website and social media platforms. You can find us on all major podcast platforms as well as our website at www.bodyofcrimepodcast.com, where you can access all of our episodes and bonus content, including valuable resources. By expanding our community, we believe we can make a greater impact in our pursuit of truth and in shedding light on crucial cases.
If there's a case that you'd like for us to cover or a personal story you'd like to share, please don't hesitate to contact us through our website. We always welcome your feedback and suggestions. Until next time, stay sharp, and thank you for tuning in to the Body of Crime Podcast.
Bye.